Hare Krishna.
Okay, the first question for me here is, how should we respond to Christians that say Jesus Christ is the only path to salvation and God's kingdom? Well, we may respond to different people in the way they say it, but basically, if anyone says this to us, they're not likely to be interested to hear anything that we have to say, because they think we're already agents of Satan, and if they listen to us, that they'll be in a lot of trouble. So there isn't that much point in trying to speak to people who are not interested to hear. My observation in this country, which I don't come to very much, I've been coming to on and off since the late 1980s, is that many of the Christians who used to say this don't say this anymore, because they found out that if they're not ready to listen to others, that no one's ready to listen to them. I can say from my own personal experience, growing up in a Christian family, that from a young age, it was clear to me that Jesus Christ was a great teacher, but he wasn't the only one in the world. There are many people from many traditions, even predating that of Jesus Christ, who were highly advanced spiritually. So to claim that there's only one path, it doesn't seem to respond to reality. And it doesn't make God look very good. For instance, I spent a few years in Thailand, where the Thai identity is fully integrated with Buddhism. In the minds of Thai people, to be a Thai is to be a Buddhist, even though there are some Muslims in Thailand also. But the majority Thai people don't consider them to be fully or properly Thai. So they're very much identify with being a Buddhist. So even if we say to them that, well, Jesus is the only way, they're preconditioned not to hear that, not to accept that. So does this mean that God put some people in to be born in some part of the world whereby the very culture that they're born in, that they're practically predestined to go to hell and burn forever? Doesn't seem to paint God as a very good person. Now, what I understood, I heard one analysis of this. Apparently, I'm not presenting myself as a great biblical scholar here, but apparently the statement of Jesus where he is purported to have said, I am the only way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to God but me, is only in the Gospel of John, not in the other three, which the other three are called the Synoptic Gospels, and John's is different, and that's the last of the four Gospels that got admitted into the Bible out of the many others that weren't included in the Bible. So, if it's really such a crucial statement, how did it not get into the other three Gospels, is one point. And another point is that according to, again, what I read, one scholar, he said that the way this is written is in the present tense. I'm not very good at grammar. I think that's the present perfect, which means right now in this place, I am the one, which was true at that time in Palestine. But it doesn't mean in all times and all places throughout all of history. Just like if I say right now, I am answering questions about Krishna consciousness. That is true for Washington Square Park in New York City in 2014, June the 12th. Is it 12th or 13th? 13th. 14th! Wow, I'm really out of date. A genuine non-New Yorker. Yeah, I don't know. Many times I wake up in the morning, I wonder where I am. I'm in a different place every day. So, if I say that, that's true. But it doesn't mean that I'm the only person in all times and all places who's ever answered questions about Krishna consciousness. So, if anyone's interested, we could say to them like this. But mostly, someone who comes on like this, they're very convinced that we have got the only way and everyone else is completely wrong, and it's not possible to discuss with others. I often present, because I am presenting teachings of Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita means the song of God, Krishna speaking to Arjuna. So that's, you could say, it's something similar to Allah speaking to Muhammad, or God speaking to Moses. But I often present that it's a completely different kind of presentation. The fact that God is speaking presupposes that God expects us to have some intelligence to understand. And so in Bhagavad Gita, we don't find Krishna, God, saying to the hearer, Arjuna, you just believe what I say, otherwise you're going to burn in hell forever. He doesn't say that. He teaches. Krishna takes the position of a guru, a teacher, who teaches spiritual knowledge. And Arjuna asks questions, sometimes very challenging questions. But Krishna speaks to Arjuna on the platform of intelligence and convinces him that you should follow this path. This is for your real self-interest, and here's why. And Krishna presents in a manner which we can call scientific. Scientific means you can understand it with your intelligence. God has given us some intelligence. So we should exercise that intelligence to understand Him. Now Krishna begins His teachings in Bhagavad Gita by explaining the difference between the body and the self. That is the beginning of spiritual understanding. There's no question of spiritual understanding unless we understand what spirit means. Spirit is different to matter. Matter is by nature perishable. Spirit is imperishable. This body is perishable. Spirit is eternal. So the first teaching of Bhagavad Gita, it's not presented that, look, just believe it, but it's presented, just understand it. You see, this body has changed. this body, which I call my body, or I think is me, it's now 57 years old. According to science, so I'm told, I'm not a scientist, but we've all heard things told by scientists, every 7 years, every cell in the body changes. So that means I've been through 8 different bodies. But I still think that this is me. And if I see a photo of myself at 6 years old, I will think this is me. And if my mother was still alive in the present body that she was in, she would recognize me. But I could say to her, hey, wait a minute. I'm not your son. Your son died 50 years ago because all the chemicals changed. So there's something which is the same, which remains the same. What is it that stays the same? Is it the mind? No, because the mind is changing at every moment. You could say the genetic code stays the same. The DNA stays the same. But I am not chemicals. You are not chemicals. This body is made of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen. There's some gold in there also. Don't cut me up and try and find it, please. It's not economically worthwhile to do so. There's some gold in there also. But I am not chemicals. You are not chemicals. We are eternal living beings. Before this body existed, I existed. You existed. How old are you, sir? 58, one ahead of me. You're my senior. So did you ever think where you were 60 years ago? You existed. You are more than that body. It's good to know when you're hitting 60 and the body's not as lively as it was when it was 16. You are an eternal living being. When the body dies, we go to another body. We continue to exist. We are too much. We are, as living beings, we are too essential, too substantial an entity to be simply a combination of chemicals. So that is the first teaching of Bhagavad Gita, that the body is temporary, it must die, but we are eternal. We live forever. And here's another important point. We are meant for being happy. We're not meant for suffering. But this world is a world of suffering. We can't avoid it. We can't avoid suffering in this world. But spiritual existence means eternal existence in blissful life, and that bliss is the bliss of love. Now, love is one of those words which everyone's heard of. If we say what it is, everyone's got an idea of, but it's really difficult to understand what it is exactly. But real love is spiritual love, which means it's eternal, it's perfect, and complete. No love in this world can be eternal. We love someone and they die, or we die before them, or we have a bust up. But real love is eternal and perfect and complete. And the object of love, the center of love for all living beings, is Krishna. Krishna can be translated into English as God, but we prefer to say Krishna because the word God has a lot of misunderstandings attached to it. So this is what I would say to someone who's not a Christian, because the Christian wouldn't listen, probably. So what is the other question? But the point is that God has given us intelligence, and although we can't understand God only through intelligence, We can't understand anything only through intelligence. We have very limited intelligence. Even New Yorkers, if you don't mind me saying so, you also have limited intelligence. But intelligence is also it's a major factor of our being. And we can't, or we shouldn't, base our whole life without thinking about it and without intelligently understanding. That was my question when I was a kid, that I was raised in a Catholic family, and we learned that if you don't believe in the Pope, you go to the hell. And then on the other side of the road is the Protestant school, where they say, if you do believe in God, if you do believe in the Pope, you go to hell. And I thought, this is really dangerous. It's like a game of Russian roulette or something. There's no intelligent way for me to understand which is right. So I thought that if I saw God coming, the judgment day came, I'd stand in the middle of the road and see which side he landed on and run on that side and say, I'm a Protestant or I'm a Catholic. But there should be some intelligent way of understanding. That's my point. So another question. Can we as humans be as a benefit or a detriment to the evolution of lesser life forms? Or do we have no effect on the evolution of other life forms? Okay. Multitasking. Okay. Presumably this is based on, this question is based on the Neo-Darwin Wallace evolutionary theory, which if we accept it, it would seem that if we accept that theory to be true, well, it certainly seems that humans are highly contributing to the devolution of other species, and not to speak of the extinction of other species. But then if we accept the survival of the fittest, then maybe that's all part of it. But anyway, we here in the Hare Krishna movement don't subscribe to the evolutionary theory of life. That we say that life, first of all, what is life? Can life be scientifically defined? We can say that the difference between life and death is a living body, the functions, at least the essential functions, respiratory function, heart, brain, these are all going on. But then there are cases of yogis who completely suspend their bodily functions. They can be as if dead for days on end. So life is not defined in material terms, and we are more than the body. The body is temporary. The body is matter. The body is composed of chemicals. But we are more than chemicals. That's the good news. So the idea that life has evolved from human life has evolved from less evolved species, we don't accept that. We are in the intelligent design camp, which if you accept it as a scientific hypothesis, there's nothing observable in the world to contradict it. The only thing is that there's that guy who atheists don't like called God in the picture. But if we accept it as a scientific hypothesis that someone has designed all of this, well, it fits very nicely. Where's that steel glass of mine? Steel glass, that's an Indian term. You can, you're good at that. Okay, all right. Okay, that's a better one. this is a scientific exhibit of something that came into being without any intelligent purpose behind it. It just came into being by a random combination of chemicals. Any takers? Impossible. Anyone like to contest that? Impossible. Possible? This came into being without... I just found it and I did some research and I found out that actually just by a random combination of chemicals without any purpose, without any design, no intelligence, it just came into being. Will anyone believe it? No. Better example. The watchman. But I think this is a better example because it's quite simple. But if you think, if you consider how much intelligence has gone into making this. Thousands of people's contributions went into making this. For instance, to design it so that it's just thick, it's not thicker than it needs to be. It's just at the right thickness. If I squeeze it, I'm not a world champion weightlifter, as you can probably guess, but I can't crush it. And this lid fits on very nicely. And I've carried it all over the world for many years, and it's still good. Someone made this stainless steel with the exact admixture of carbon or whatever. Then you have to go and find the ingredients, mine it. You have to make a machine, and then you have to think it's going to be economical. You're going to make a profit by manufacturing it. There's a manufacturer, there's middleman, there's a retailer. There are thousands of people's intelligence have contributed to this, which after all is quite a simple thing. It's probably not seen much in New York, but it's a standard kind of thing in India. Okay, you want to say something about this? Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Right.
Just to finish that point, I didn't give the punchline. The punchline is that if such a simple thing as this, we cannot imagine it coming into being without some intelligent design, then what to speak of the whole universe and everything within it? As a kid studying biology in school, I was taught that the cells in the human body are simple organisms, and that soon we shall be able to reproduce them, starting with raw chemicals in the laboratory. Later on, I did my exam, I passed. Nowadays, if I wrote that, the same thing, I would fail, because they've discovered that actually the cells, even the most simple cell, is extremely complicated. And what I found out after that is that scientists, at the time I was being taught that in school, they already knew that the cells are much more complicated, but they hadn't updated the syllabus at the time, so they were teaching what they knew to be wrong. What do you call that? Cheating? Cheating, yeah, cheating. Okay, please go ahead.
Yeah, the thank you, Maharaj, for letting me say a few words. About, actually, I find the subject of Darwinism very inspiring and very, very helpful in my own faith, in my own determination, my own conviction about theism. We call it Krishna consciousness, but in a general sense, we could say theism as opposed to atheism. I was brought up in an atheistic, nominally Jewish, but basically atheistic milieu. And I owe a debt of gratitude to a Catholic gentleman, and I think Maharaj may have read Michael Behe, B-E-H-E.
Oh, yeah.
Have any of you heard of Michael Behe? Maybe not. Anyway, I don't want to plagiarize his
Darwin's Black Box,
but even better is 11 years later, he wrote a book called The Edge of Evolution. And he's a microbiologist. He's not giving any religious arguments. At the end, he gets kind of philosophical, but the crux of the book is that it makes it so simple to understand that there must be intelligent design. Who the designer is not the issue, as far as he goes. But for the atheist, it's a slippery slope. Because once you understand that there must have been an intelligent designer, and some people, even the likes of Richard Dawkins, the most famous atheist in the world, has even come out in an interview in the funny movie by Stein, what's his name, the comedian. He even said that, well, maybe there must be intelligent design, but it can't be God. That's all right. We've got you. Because once you admit that there must be intelligent design, you go down, for them, the slippery slope. Actually, it's an upward slope towards God. Because if you say it came from some trans sperm, something from aliens planted the intelligence, then who created the aliens? How did they get that super intelligence? In other words, you finally get to the absolute. You get to the supreme cause of all causes. So we don't have any problem with that. Natural selection also, we don't have much of a problem with. Common descent, well, we don't like to think we came from the apes, but in one sense, we don't really disagree, because in reincarnation, if I can go on a little bit, if reincarnation, we understand from the Vedic scriptures that there are three life forms that lead to the human form. And if one is a human being in what we call the mode of goodness, an elevated state, his life in the animal form was mother cow or father bull. In other words, those are the, you might say, most sattvic animals that lead one to the human. And then in the mode of passion, the tiger and the lion. And the mode of ignorance, guess what? Our friend the monkey. So the Vedic scriptures don't completely deny that. We may have a different route of how we came. For one thing, we say common descent. Okay, we came from Krishna, we came from Lord Brahma. That's our common descent. The first sexual reproduction was Svayambhuva Manu and Satarupa. So that's our Adam and Eve. So there's common descent. So we don't have a major issue. It's actually devolution. It's not evolution, because we start with the most highly complex Lord Brahma, and it works down, which makes more sense according to probability theory. Okay, but what do we have the real problem with is this variety by random selection. That Michael Behe proves without any shadow of a doubt that it is just no probability. Or you can have one with...
anthropic principle.
Yeah, well, there's also design implied in the conditions for life.
Dawkins talks about the anthropic principle.
Yeah, well, which
doesn't really say anything at all. Dawkins talks about the anthropic principle, which means there are so many constants in the universe which are required to have the universe as it now, just like the weak forces and the gravitational force and this force and that force, and there are about 24 of them, and they're all the possibility, they're all fine-tuned to like to the power of minus 1000 or something, and they all have to be in place to have the universe as it is. But according to Dawkins, well, we're here, so that proves that we're here, and it's called the anthropic principle.
That's called the weak anthropic principle, which is just a circular statement. It's a tautology. It doesn't mean anything. The strong anthropic principle gets dangerously theistic. Then it gets into something called teleology. It starts talking about purpose, and it starts to imply a purpose and a purposeful creator. So, yes, the fine-tuning of the universe. In other words, the universe had to be designed just to create the conditions so there could be some kind of evolution, we can say. And then once you get those conditions for life, then that requires so much serendipity that it's absurd. These things have to work together so well, just by chance. There's only, in most species, at least in mammals, there's only one mutation in 100 million. And
even
most...
Even that's not true.
Yeah, and most mutations cause deterioration. A mutation doesn't help the organism. Mutations generally hurt them. It's just circumstantially, in certain specific situations, there could be a secondary benefit, as in the case of resistance to chloroquine in malarial pathogens. In certain situations, the resistance to HIV drugs. And that's because what they're doing is it's like breaking something. It's easier to break something than to make something. So in other words, the question isn't, Hare Krishna, the question isn't so much the survival of the fittest, but the arrival of the fittest. It's how did that complex machinery come about? And anyway, I strongly recommend that you make a note of, if you're all interested in this subject, Michael Behe. He proves very conclusively that this idea that just by random selection, it's like you take some monkeys and you have them bang on typewriters, what is the possibility that they'll produce Shakespearean literature? You can say everything's possible. Let's say, well, we have so much time. Well, what's 4 billion years? That's nothing. You have those monkey pounding for 4 billion years. Would they produce all the works of Shakespeare? And that's nothing compared to what goes on in biology. So anyway, these are just some ideas for thought. Thank you for letting me suggest that, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna. Other question. Is it possible to understand the infinite in this finite existence, or should we humble ourselves to say we may not know what is to come or understand the divine existence until we arrive there? Yeah, we are finite beings. There is infinity. Being not just finite, but infinitesimal, if we consider, how great are we? Tiny, 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 tiny little beings with very limited, very, very little intelligence, actually. Very, very little knowledge, very, very little understanding. How can we understand the infinite? So the question is, or the proposition is, that we should become humble and say that we don't know, we don't understand it until we arrive there. How are we going to understand that we arrive there? You have to go on a journey to get there. We, as is apparent from this question, although we are infinitesimal, we have a propensity to reach out to try to connect with the infinite. So, we can, being infinitesimal, we can reach to the infinite by the grace of the infinite. Otherwise, the possibility of our doing so is infinitesimal. If we have to go from our infinitesimal position to understanding the infinite, that's not possible, because infinitesimal means we are completely limited. We don't really understand anything. That's the point which is being made here. But by the grace of the infinite, we can be infused with infinite mercy and infinite understanding. So by our own endeavor, we're never going to reach to the infinite position, but by the mercy of the infinite, we can begin to understand and communicate and connect with the infinite. That is called yoga. Yoga means to link. Yoga is meant for linking with the infinite. Generally, people think that infinite means impersonal, no person. But infinite means impersonal and personal. If we say that the infinite is not a person, then that means we put some limit. So infinite means everything is there complete. So infinite means there is the supreme infinite person who's also distributed impersonally. He has infinite love, that's the most important thing. And by his infinite mercy, we can reach to him, to the infinite. So if we think I'll be humble, I'm infinitesimal and I don't really know what the infinite is, so I'll just wait till I get there, but we'll never go, because you have to make a journey. You have to go to what? You have to have some idea of where we're going. Otherwise, we'll just remain in this limited world. So therefore, God, the infinite, out of his kindness comes to this world, sends his representatives, and gives us information about himself and about the infinite, and how we can make progress on the path toward infinity, infinite love. How to start that process? There are different approaches. Very easy, joyful, and effective process is by chanting the names of Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. If we chant this name in humility, as the asker of this question has made this important point about being humble, if we humbly accept that we are infinitesimal, we have no personal strength or intelligence to reach the infinite, but let us accept this process given by the infinitely kind personality of Godhead. Let us chant these names. Then we immediately start to make progress toward the condition of the infinite. We are limited in this world by material desire. We have to overcome material desire before we can enter into the realm of the infinite. So that requires discipline, following spiritual principles. It's not just a matter of applying our intelligence or imagining ourselves to be spiritual. Hare Krishna. There are many things to say, but in this format, not so much can be said. So, Sorry. Oh, I see. Okay. So, obviously, if we are to make serious spiritual progress, we're going to have to do more than sit in a questions and answers booth and pass what we might consider to be an interesting afternoon. We have to pursue it in seriousness. We have to make a spiritual commitment. If one does detrimental actions to themselves and is born as an animal, how do they break that cycle and reincarnate as a human being again? If due to sinful activity someone goes from the animal from the human species in the next life takes an animal birth, there's nothing he can do until he gets back to the human birth. So one has to understand the importance of this human birth and take advantage of it. Otherwise, we may spend many lifetimes in lower species of life. So take it seriously. We have the human form of life now. There is a verse spoken by Krishna in this regard, most important. Labdvasu durlabham idam bahu sambhavante manusham artadam anityam apihadhira turnam yatetana patedanu mritya yavan nishrayasaya vishaya kalu sarvatasya. If we could understand the importance of this teaching, we wouldn't waste a moment of our life. I'll translate this verse now. The meaning is that whoever can understand the meaning of this verse is in a human body. Animals, they cannot understand this. If we're in a human body, that means we've come to it after many, many, many births. Now we are in a human body. This is the opportunity which we don't have in non-human births. We now have the opportunity to get free from the cycle of birth and death. It's not possible if we're in the form of a cat or a tree or a monkey or a pig or a fish or whatever. It's possible in the human form. Now we have the human form. Therefore, now that we have this very rare human form of life, before we die again, we've died many times, we've been born many times, we're going to die again. And it won't take long because life doesn't last very long. We should have the resolve that before I die this time, I should do whatever is required that I don't get born again. Think about it. And if we think that, well, I have so many things, there are so many things to enjoy, I can go surfboarding or I can go to Broadway and watch a production and I can go to a restaurant, we've already done it. In millions of lifetimes. Everything that's to be enjoyed in this world, we've been through it already. There's nothing we haven't been through. And there's nothing we won't get to be thrown back into again. So forget all this idea that I shall be happy in this world. It's not possible. Do what is required so we don't get born again. We don't have to suffer repeated birth and death. Please think about it. Are we taking only written questions? Is that the format? Could you please write it down? Do you believe in samskaras? If so, how do you accelerate your reincarnation? Samskara is a word which maybe many of you don't understand. In this context, it means, samskara means an impression in the consciousness which influences our behavior and it influences our life and our future lives. Everything that we perceive, everything we touch, taste, smell, feel, hear, or think about, it leaves an impression in the consciousness. And those impressions, they influence our way of thinking and our way of acting. By coming here and listening to this, you're also being influenced. If you don't like it, go away now. If you like it, you can stay. But everything we do makes an impression on our consciousness. And the sum total of Pradyumna. Hare Krishna. Hare Bol. Well, I'm here till 6 o'clock. See you then. So, at the time of death, the sum total of the impressions that we have accumulated, that will make a great impression on our consciousness, and that will lead us to our next birth. Therefore, in human life, we should choose how we live, what we allow to enter our minds. If we think, okay, I'll just sit down and watch TV, we're allowing things to come into our consciousness, which will influence our consciousness, which will influence our actions, which will influence our future births. There are three main derogatory types of impressions. They are called kama, krodha, and lobha. Kama means material desire. Krodha means anger or frustration. And lobha means greed. Now just consider, what you see on TV is nothing but kama, krodha, and lobha. Kama means material desire. It, what you watch that incites desire, and especially advertisements, and krodha, violence, and lobe, again advertisements, get this, buy this. So it negatively affects our consciousness. So it's being asked to accelerate our reincarnation, but actually we should choose how we live and choose what we accept within our consciousness so that our consciousness is purified. Purified means to become free from lust, anger, greed, pride, illusion, envy, and all the bad qualities that cause us to be born again and again and again. So this Krishna consciousness is meant for purifying our consciousness, to be free of lust, greed, anger, envy, illusion, pride, to have pure consciousness. Pure consciousness means Krishna consciousness. When our consciousness is completely pure, then that means at the time of death, there will be no more material impressions in our mind. There will only be spiritual impressions, and we will be transferred to the spiritual world. So the question is, do you believe in sanskaras? Often we are asked, do you believe in this? Do you believe in that? My answer to such a question is always, it doesn't matter what we believe. Do you believe in God? Do you believe in reincarnation? It doesn't matter whether you believe in God. It doesn't matter whether you believe in reincarnation. In the sense that whether you believe in it or not, it's either true or not true. Do you believe we are in New York? If you believe it, it's true. And if you don't believe it, it's also true. So whether we believe it or not is not the question. We should try to understand what is the fact. Is there God or isn't there? Either there is God or there isn't God. It's not that, well, I don't believe in God. God doesn't exist. Okay, I believe in God. Okay, God, now you can exist because I believe in you. But what is fact is fact. It doesn't depend on our belief. So the very question, do you believe, it's a trivial question. We shouldn't be so trivial as to base our whole life on unsubstantiated belief. We should find out what is the fact. We should try to find out what is the fact. These are very important questions. Is there life after death? It's one hell of an important question, isn't it? We should try to find out. There are ways of finding out. So, please don't ask, what do you believe? Are you writing this? Should get someone better handwriting. I mean, it's not a question of belief. It's actually not very legible handwriting. Okay. The guru showed help and, for instance, stop war, yet why didn't they stop Hitler and Stalin, etc.? Well, I'm sorry, I need an interpreter for that. I don't understand what it means. I'm sorry, whoever gave this question, if you could kindly rephrase it, because... Is it your question?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, please.
In spiritual
part, like you, excuse me. I know that's not considered proper behavior, but I don't have a tissue to spit into.
So I learned that some gurus say that they can do everything.
Some gurus said they can do everything. If you find a guru like that, run away from them as quickly as you can. It's in the book. Well, throw that book away. Guru means someone... The guru, in the proper sense of the term, means someone who teaches the truth. The guru is someone who teaches the truth, but a guru is not infinite. One of the truths he has to teach is that he's also finite. He may have knowledge of the infinite, but he's not infinite. A guru doesn't mean he's God who can do everything. Guru means who teaches about God. So if a guru says, I can do everything, you know he's a cheater. You should have enough sense to understand he's a cheater. Did he say he can do everything? Maybe a guru can make rain, maybe. But the real... Yeah. Not that I'm aware of. Yeah. So I'm not sure. I'm sorry. I'm not a great student but of the Bible. But yeah, exactly. A guru means teacher. And there can be a sitar teacher, a martial art teacher. They're also gurus. But in the best sense of, or in the highest sense of the term, guru means who teaches the highest knowledge. Therefore, you're talking about the book. In the spiritual books, it's taught, Tad vijnanartham sagurum eva bhigacchet. To attain that knowledge, one should approach a guru. That knowledge means the knowledge after one has seen this world and seen that there's nothing substantial in this world. Wherever you go in this world, there's suffering. There's repeated birth and death. When one has seen this, then one should go to a guru to get that knowledge by which one can become free from the insubstantiality of this world. A literal translation of the word guru is heavy. Heavy, heavy means grave, heavy with knowledge. So, tadvijnanartham sagurum eva bhigacchet. One should approach a guru, and the symptoms of a guru are that, what is that? Brahmanya upasha. Shrotriyam Brahmanishtam. That's it, in two words. There's the other verse also, which I was trying to get. One thing is that he's heard. He's not making up anything. He doesn't make up anything. That knowledge is in human society. He has heard it from a teacher. He teaches what he has heard. It's not that I'm just making something up. And Brahmanishtha means he's fixed in that knowledge. So a guru doesn't say, I can do everything. That is God. Guru points you to God who can do everything. Why doesn't God stop Stalin? Why doesn't God stop the slaughterhouses? There are, you're talking about Stalin, who is genocidal. There's a genocide going on in America every day. Literally thousands and millions of animals are being killed. And abortions. It's not only, the animals also suffer. Why don't we think about that? People like Stalin and Hitler come because we kill so many animals. And then people like Stalin and Hitler come as instruments of the evil which we perpetrate ourselves. What goes around comes around. So if you don't want another Stalin or another Hitler, we should close the slaughterhouses. The slaughterhouses of humans happen because there are slaughterhouses of animals. Yeah. So there's a reason for everything. There's suffering in this world. Man is the architect of his own fortune. We make the suffering. We made Hitler. We made Stalin. We are making the next, whoever it is. We're all responsible. We're all responsible. This country, I mean, this, I don't know how far I want to take this, but this country is living in opulence. America is a rich country. By exploitation of other countries. If we exploit, we have to suffer. It goes in a cycle. It works like this. Someone performs pious activities. They get born in a situation where they can live in opulence, like in America at the present time. They misuse that opportunity to exploit others. Then they go down in the next birth and they'll be exploited. And it goes on round and round and round and round like this until we understand that this whole world is a world of the cheaters and the cheated. We have to get out of this cycle. We cause our own suffering. We cause suffering to others, and by that we cause suffering to ourselves. So God can stop this, but we have to choose. He gives us the opportunity. He comes, he speaks, Bhagavad Gita. He gives us the spiritual knowledge by which we can choose to stop living an exploitive life. How do you do that if society makes you do otherwise? Well, we have to exercise our free will. We have free will. We don't have to do what society apparently dictates us to do. Am I over time? Almost. We have free will. We can use it or misuse it. The force of society is very strong, no doubt, to not be a consumer, to not be in line with everyone else. It's very difficult, but we can choose. If we get this knowledge by which we can choose to live our life in such a way that we will be elevated instead of carried along with the crowd. We don't know where we're going. I mean, actually, don't mind me saying so, but even in New York, most people are really stupid. We just accept political leaders, sports icons, fashion icons. It's just stupid. We never think about what is the real meaning of life. I want to be happy eternally. Why am I not? Why am I in a body which is doomed. We should at least think about this and seriously pursue the answers. Just to be carried away by what everyone is doing is not intelligent. We do have free will. We do have intelligence. We have to use that properly. Ramapad Swami Maharaj is now going to tell you more about it. He might not be as, probably won't be as insulting as I am. But I know New Yorkers can take it. I don't know how many New Yorkers are here. They're usually in a too much of a rush for things like this.
No, New Yorkers like...
They like a bit of...
repartee.
Give and take.
Okay.
Hare Krishna.
And not only that, in God we trust. Well, he kind of like...
wrote the civil rights, wrote those ideas to protect us from the group.
Okay, but...
excuse me, can I just make a disclaimer?
Yeah,
just a little disclaimer here. I was just trying to prick you a bit. I'm not anti-American. I'm not even anti-New York, believe it or not. We love this city. Prabhupada came here. Hare Krishna.